Welcome to The Latest on the Law, a podcast of the Boston Bar Association. The Commonwealth's premier legal association, the BBA is home to over 15,000 members and 140 institutional partners consisting of law firms, corporations, government agencies, legal aid organizations, and law schools. Visit us at bostonbar.org to learn more.
And thank you all for joining. I'm really excited about this conversation that we're going to be having today. I wanted to just start by saying why we're all here today, which is, again, we want to look and take a closer look at what the Department of Corrections is and is not doing to address the needs of people with mental health conditions. And as many of you probably know, there is a significant amount of people who are incarcerated who have some sort of mental health issue. SAMHSA estimates that it's about 37% of people who are incarcerated have some mental health condition. And that's not counting people who are in the system, who are experiencing the stress and trauma of just simply being there. And so we have a line of panelists today who are experts and who have in-depth knowledge of what's going on inside the Department of Corrections and who are going to speak to what are the issues, what is going on in DOC, what are the problems that are rising up when it comes to addressing mental health needs. We'll also be talking about possible solutions, what are things that each of these panelists are doing to address some of these problems, as well as ways that you all as participants can join in and help, because we definitely need more people to get involved. So I'm going to first start off by introducing our panelists. But before I do that, I just want to encourage you all, this is meant to be interactive. I know you can't speak, but we want you to drop in questions. The panelists really have a lot they want to share, and it really helps to guide the conversation if there are things that you all want to hear about. So please feel free to drop in at any time, any questions that you have. And without further ado, let me go ahead and introduce our panelists, starting with Eric Anderson. Eric is a returning community member, poet, mentor, chef, director, father, human, a lifetime student of restorative practices, and self-proclaimed street kid. He has over 8 years of leadership experience with restorative practices and community-based initiatives. Eric also serves as a director of communications and special projects at the Transformational Prison Project. TPP is dedicated to providing spaces where those who have been harmed and those who have done the harming can unite and engage in dialogue. We also have Jesse White, who serves as the Legislative Director of Prisoners Legal Services, an organization dedicated to challenging the carceral system through litigation, advocacy, client counseling, partnership with impacted individuals and communities, and outreach to policymakers and the public in order to promote the human rights of incarcerated individuals and end harmful confinement. Next, we have Ivy Moody, who is a staff attorney at the Mental Health Legal Advisors Committee, a legal services judicial aid agency in Massachusetts that works to secure and protect the legal rights of persons with mental health, intellectual, and developmental disabilities. Ivy specializes in prisons and policing with a focus on the decriminalization of mental health. Before joining the staff at MHLAC, she was a deputy public defender with the Colorado State Public Defender's Office in Colorado Springs, Colorado. We next have Representative Erica Oyderhoven. I'm hoping I'm saying that right. and she is a state representative for Somerville. Erica founded Act En Masse, the lead organization advocating for transparency and progressive causes in the Massachusetts State House. Erica has worked closely with state representatives, unions, and progressive advocacy organizations to fight for key wins in the legislature. And finally, I want to introduce my co-moderator, Rena Parikh, who is the Assistant Clinical Professor, Director of Civil Rights Clinic, and the Sung Research Award recipient at Boston College Law. Under her supervision, her clinic students, on behalf of low-wage workers, immigrants, incarcerated individuals, and communities of color in Massachusetts, advocate through litigation and policy advocacy for these communities. So Rena is going to be helping me moderate the chat. And without further ado, let's go ahead and just dive in. And first, I want to set the context for folks and talk a little bit about what is going on in DOC. And so the first question I have for you all is, what are the mental health issues that you're seeing in prisons? What is, can you kind of just paint that picture for folks? And I'll start with maybe Eric, if you could just speak to that a little bit.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody, for being here. For me, one of the biggest mental health issue is the lack of mental health, if that makes sense. There is really no direct mental health services there if you're not in what they call a crisis, in essence, trying to kill yourself or having suicidal thoughts. There is no mental health. You cannot just go speak to somebody. You cannot just go and offload what you're going through that day, offload those stresses, offload that hard time you had at court that day, you know, be able to process your thoughts. And I say that lucky enough to have been a part of a restorative community where I had brothers inside that can do that. But as far as the DOC, they provide no services unless you're on that verge of wanting to harm yourself or on the process of harming yourself. So for me, that's one of the biggest lacks of mental health in there and the biggest cause, because you're not able to process. You know, you're not able, you don't have avenues to process your thoughts. You have to live with them. You're locked inside of a cage. Especially when you're in solitary confinement, you're in a cage by yourself for 23 hours a day with only your own thoughts. It's 10 minutes is too much to run something through your brain sometime. And us out here to go through Google, we already know what Google would do, drive you crazy trying to find or research something. Imagine sitting with your own thoughts for 23 hours and trying to figure, you're going to, you know, you lead you that way. So for me, that's one of the biggest, hardest things when it comes to mental health and what causes a lot, I think, of the mental health problems is there's no outlets. Inside that place.
Thank you, Eric. Jesse, would you also want to add to that? Or
Yeah. I think Eric definitely identified a lot of the key problems. I would just add that the carceral environment is inherently traumatizing. And so even to the extent folks can obtain, you know, very limited mental health services, you're talking about providing those services in an extremely traumatizing environment. So, you know, folks who have anxiety disorders, folks who have PTSD, folks who have major depressive disorder, you know, all of those are going to be ongoing harms that are happening even while people are ostensibly being treated for those harms. So some of what we really need to do is change the underlying environment and also recognize that there will never really be appropriate mental health care in the prison system. It's not possible to provide appropriate mental health care in a system that is completely anti-therapeutic and where people don't have any means of, you know, controlling their own environment in order to decrease the harms that they're experiencing. The other thing that I would just add, you know, is that a big challenge is that clinical staff and correctional staff work very closely with one another. So it's very difficult to develop trust in that environment with a clinician who, you know, is likely to speak to correctional officers and violate all of your HIPAA rights. And you know that whatever you say could easily get back to folks whose primary job is really to punish you beyond anything else. And because of that, we see a lot of reliance by clinical staff on diagnoses that can be used and are used to stigmatize instead of treat people. So we see a lot of folks who are diagnosed with personality disorders, which are often stigmatized, often considered untreatable. And we don't actually see those disorders manifest in our interactions with folks, which really calls into question, you know, why are people being diagnosed with what they're being diagnosed with? And what kind of treatments are really available inside of this very, 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 very difficult environment? And then when the worst case happens and someone does express that they're in crisis of some kind, their response to that is not a therapeutic response, it's a punitive response. So people are stripped naked, put alone into a cell with nothing but what's called a suicide smock on, and not provided much of anything in the way of actual therapeutic response. And not only that, but the underlying cause of the crisis is almost never addressed. You know, so you've got people who cycle in and out of crisis and then back to solitary and then crisis and then back to solitary and then crisis and back to solitary, which raises the question, you know, why do we keep putting people back in solitary when we know it's causing the crisis? I'll leave it there.
Thank you, Jesse. Ivy, I wanted to give you space as well. It's just, if you want to add to that.
I just want to lay a bit of a groundwork too, and I think we touched on it, but so DOC contracts with a private company to provide all of the mental and health care in these facilities. And so when we're talking about right now, we're talking about this company called WellPath, a for-profit company that takes a contract, and what they get for profit is what they don't spend. So we're starting from a place where the healthcare is a for-profit industry. Beyond that, we see that DOC is very involved in the clinical treatment of folks in a way that they're just not qualified to do. And so there's a lot we see around, you know, stigmatization for sure that Jesse touched on, but we're also seeing biases, subconscious and very conscious biases on what is behavioral versus what is a mental health challenge. You know, we know the numbers on the men's side are about 47% being diagnosed with a mental health, and the women's side, it creeps up to around 90%, but we don't see that in a treatment. Most people are receiving 15 minutes once a month of talk therapy, and that's really just to cover them on the psychotropic medication. That's not actual therapy. And, you know, we can't fix underlying issues in 15 minutes a month. That's just ridiculous. And so DOC will punish or call something behavioral because that's much more, it's just easier for them to treat. So we're seeing just a cycle of really challenging things. And, you know, we're not talking about parole and reintegration into the community so much today, but, you know, a lot of people, they talk about recidivism without talking about treatment and release plans and helping people actually get on their feet. And we do see, and we're currently in litigation with the parole board for just using mental health as a reason not to give people parole. So we see that it's a huge part of the decision making within DOC and EOHHS, but we don't see it as a priority in terms of budgeting and actually providing services. So I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Ivy. And Representative, did you want to add to that?
I fully wholeheartedly agree with everything people said earlier. I'll just add one more lens to this, which I just want to reiterate the point that prisons and corrections are just not a place anyone can get any sort of therapeutic or mental health care. And I will want to add an additional lens to that, which is that as far as the legislature goes, we struggle to have the DOC follow the statute and the laws that we have passed. And I'll just give two very clear examples of that. One is that we have put in place in 2018 ways to reduce significantly the usage of solitary confinement for extended periods of time. And the DOC has just blatantly violated that law by saying that they move people from one, you know, cell, which they spent most of the day, 21 hours, and then say we move them to another cell for 3 hours, and that's considered out of cell time. That is not what we intended when we wrote that law. And so to see sort of these backflips to maneuver and navigate the legislation, because ultimately, when people are held in solitary, apart from reasons like retaliation or just kind of issues that are just completely unjustified, a lot of times people are held in solitary for long periods of time because they have been untreated mental health issues or untreated drug, you know, addiction challenges or whatever that may be. But instead of getting them care, we essentially just put them in the highest security imaginable, which is in itself traumatizing. Another piece I want to share too, again, this is where the lens of approaching everything as a corrections problem just simply doesn't address at a fundamental level the mental health issues. Disciplinary reports. You're not supposed to be giving disciplinary reports based on your disability or your mental health issues, but then the struggle is that they do not because there's a lack of mental health care or clinicians, there's no diagnosis, there's nothing on file, right? And so they'll claim that, no, this was just a behavioral issue. And really, it wasn't. There were other underlying factors involved, but you're essentially issuing disciplinary reports, which has these consequences, which Ivy pointed out in terms of the lawsuit, of jeopardizing people's access to parole, right? Access to being able to get health care and mental health care in particular. And those are violations of the American Disabilities Act. So these are all these ways that simply we're not, when we write legislation and laws in a way to try to address these issues, our system and our prisons just simply do not follow them. And then at the very least, right, this is not actually getting the care that people deserve. So, you know, my view is that we absolutely need to be getting people care and not imprisonment. And so that's really the approach that I believe we need to take moving forward.
Sarah, can I add just one thing that I think is important context? So just looking at the budget that just came out of the House, the Department of Corrections budget is $840 million. About $800 million of that is facility operations, and less than $5 million is for all behavioral health and residential treatment. So this is not a money issue. This is a prioritization issue. And, you know, I just really want everyone to sit with what $840 million is going to, if not the mental behavioral health and reintegration health of these folks that we put in cages, which is only about 6,000 people. So, you know, divide that by the math and it's just, it's an obscene number. So just wanted to add that in for context.
I appreciate you sharing that. And I wanted to kind of go back to also like, so, in terms of there is no treatment there from what I'm getting from you all, but, and I'll direct this to Eric, how would people manage? Like, how do you see, and this is for everyone, but I'll start with Eric, just in terms of people who are incarcerated, like coping with these issues, like were there support systems? I'm thinking maybe if you could speak to what you saw while you were incarcerated, how did people navigate that?
If I can speak more directly to myself, for me, I didn't have a large amount of family. I had my grandmother who's in her 70s, my sister who, you know, had four or five children, you know, so people even with limited time and limited resources where everything costs even to be able to reach out to them. Everything costs for them to come spend time with me. So if it wasn't for them, but realistically, if it wasn't for the Bobby Acavellos, the Noble Williams, the Amon Comans, the Supreme Assange that created the restorative justice groups and all the rest of Tommy Kuntz and the restorative justice group inside of Norfolk Prison, I wouldn't have had a support system. It came from other prisoners. It came from prisoners trying to solve their own issues, trying to solve, create avenues for us to actually deal with our inner thoughts and the things that we wanted to get out. I'm appreciative of them of creating those avenues and, you know, leading with accountability, but realistically, if I'm honest, those are therapeutic groups. Those are places where I was able to get out the things that I spoke to no one about, that I only spoke to my little sister about, that I only had my grandmother to speak about. There was never no one in the DOC. I know they're called condition officers, but we call them caseworkers. They're not condition officers to them. They're just police officers that they wasn't able to get a badge. So we honestly don't see them that way. They're the people that classify us and mostly put us in maximum security, so they do the same job as the COs. So realistically, like I'll go back. For me, the only avenues that we really had was our fellow prisoners and our family members that, you know, have to spend more onto that budget. So, you know, the BOC is getting paid all this money and our family's paying all this money just to try to help us out in that situation. And like I said, for myself, I had a couple family members, but I know individuals that sitting there, they don't have no one to call. They have no one that comes and see them. They have no one that writes them. You know, they have no one at all. So for me, those restorative justice groups, those fatherly groups, the church services that the men run inside of there, and the support groups that the actual men and women create inside those prisons, to me, are the biggest support that most prisoners have.
I wanted to open, Ivy, did you want to share or have thoughts on what you...
Yeah, I mean, I obviously it's not my lived experience and I certainly wouldn't want to speak as if it is. But I would second that. I've heard what Eric is saying from, you know, all the folks that we talk to. And what's really scary is that there are just so many guys that are stuck and are decompensated to a level that they just don't even know where they are, right? Like, we have a significant number of people who are truly languishing. And whether that's physical, mental health, or otherwise, you know, we identify them through the companions or through someone else who's, you know, comes to us and says, yeah, my experience is horrific, but you got to go talk to this guy. You have to find this guy. And that's how we're finding people. And it's just awful to think that these COs are walking around and just letting this happen. You know, the fact that we have a companion program in a prison that assigns incarcerated men to go and help assist the other incarcerated men with basic things like showers, hygiene, eating. I mean, let's really think about what we're doing here and why we have people in cages that, you know, generally, but specifically when we're talking about folks who aren't a danger to anyone. Not that I believe in the system at all, but, you know, let's take a step back and think about what's actually happening and why someone who is that sick is in a cage and relying on other people around them to get by and to survive. But I'll pass it to Jesse.
Yeah, I would just add to what Ivy and Eric said that, you know, those internal support systems are so critical, and yet in many institutions, they're legally barred. So, you know, it requires, like, you're basically in a lot of circumstances, you're risking discipline to support or be supported by fellow incarcerated people. And it should not be that way. I mean, it's horrific enough that we're spending $140,000 per year to cage people instead of distributing that money to low-income communities who would benefit from it and where we could prevent violence and help treat mental health in the community before it gives rise to violence that results in incarceration. You know, it's bad enough that we're doing that, but then and we're not providing real mental health services with all of those funds. We're putting people in a position where they need to rely on each other and they need to rely on their families in order to get through it and endure it in any sort of way that leaves folks intact at the end of the day. And then we're telling people they're not allowed to actually do that. So at Susan Baranowski Correctional Center, the most harmful prison in the system, people are isolated 21 hours a day. They're only allowed outside of their cells in groups of six. And that's not in solitary confinement. That's in general population. There are no authorized support networks, self-improvement groups, or cultural affinity groups at that prison. And that could be changed tomorrow with a directive from the governor, from the commissioner, from the Executive Office of Public Safety and Security. We do not need a law passed to resolve that problem. There is a bill introduced to resolve that problem. But really, that's a directive that could come down from the top in minutes and get implemented, and people would benefit from it immediately.
Yeah, go ahead, Eric.
I definitely appreciate what you said, Jesse, but something I learned being in SUSE, when I first walked into SUSE, the prisoners used to not lock in their cells purposely. And this just was not saying they were doing the rightful thing. It was just overpowering the guards, realistically. Once the guards took control of that prison, they do what they want in that prison. They don't care what the governor says. They don't care what a representative says, a council person says. So I agree, yeah, this should be directive, but I think the DOC just needs a complete overhaul. Mm-hmm. The people that's in charge of the DOC do not care what the government says. They're about jobs, their families, and their livelihoods, and that's all they care. The more that they can present the safety issue, they lock us down. There was an order that came out for them to open that prison. They started to do it. As soon as they had one issue, they locked it right back down. They took out all the food. They took out all the programming. And every time, if there's one incident, they grow it to its max and they lock it down further. And I walked in that prison in 2010, where we basically spent 8 hours on our cell a day, left that prison when it was down to 3 hours a day. Where we had sugar, candy, we had none of it. We are fed as diabetic and almost the food is an equivalent of that of a person that needs health provide a nutrient health provider food. So honestly, I agree with you, but also I would like to further say that prison just needs an overhaul. All those in charge needs, I don't care if you paid them off something, they need to leave. There needs to be new faces and new people within them systems.
Thank you, Eric. And Ivy, I want to get to you, but I also want to see if Representative Erica Oederhoven, if you want to add, so if it's okay with Ivy, like I'm going to go to her and then I'll go back to you. Representative, yeah. Can you add to that? I just wanted to
build on that because I think Eric's absolutely right. They do not care. And I say that as someone who has showed up unannounced, tried to get into these facilities. I mean, literally in statute, I am written as oversight. That is my legislative mandate, is to conduct oversight. And I'm not given that ability to conduct my legislative mandate regularly. So I just wanted to kind of build on what Eric was saying. And then also to add that, I think there's this perception, and that we hear this all the time from the DOC, of like, gosh, if only we had money. And I know I said that earlier about this like lack of funding. And the reality is that what I fight every day, every week, is to allow free programming, free mental health, right, groups, whether that be through restorative justice groups that Eric was referring to at MCI Norfolk, whether it be the mental health group, which is conducted by the Lifers group at Gardner, which has, by the way, been shut down. No explanation. They just need a room to be able to meet. And that was the main source of mental health that anyone had access to, is that they were able to have a mental health group that I could meet regularly. That's been shut down. We've tried to have restorative justice practitioners and volunteers and people in the community who have lived experience with various mental health issues, who used to be able to come into the prisons regularly to provide these mental health groups. That's been shut down because it's been replaced by a for-profit contract that was put in place under the Governor Baker's administration. And instead, there are these horrible modules that everyone complains about, says it's a giant waste of their time and doesn't provide any sort of rehabilitation. And so I just wanted to emphasize how much, I mean, we can't even, when people are providing this labor and the support for free, whether it's from peer-to-peer support within the facility or with volunteers, we're up against just barrier after barrier with no explanation. We always hear staffing, lack of rooms, the lack of funding. And I will tell you with my own eyes, I've walked through these facilities and I wish that these rooms were teeming with so much activity that like we couldn't reserve a room to allow these groups to meet. That's simply just not the reality that's happening. And so it's just outrageous. I also just wanted to build up one piece too around the companion program. Incarcerated people are paid 45 cents to $1.75 an hour, and that's the best jobs. And I believe companion is on the higher end of that, but we're still talking $1 an hour to do this work, to provide essential health care and support for fellow incarcerated people. So again, this is about decisions and resources and letting the system run afoul to the law and run afoul to what we are expecting, what, you know, the public's perception expectation would be. And I think if most people could see with their own eyes the conditions, it would be truly unbelievable to anyone.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. Ivy, did you want to go ahead?
Yeah, I just wanted to add one thing that I think, you know, sometimes we talk about incarceration and DOC within the bubble of those who are, you know, incarcerated. But I just don't want to understate the generational trauma, the secondhand trauma, the, you know, continued trauma of the families, the communities, and frankly, the COs and the people employed by the DOC. I mean, the conditions, the groupthink, the violence that they are enacting is not healthy for them either. And so I think we have to remember that this hurts all of us. This is not just confined to the walls of that prison. And until we can recognize that this is a community mental health, this is a public mental health and public health issue to have so many people coming in and out of these horrific situations and all the people that touch their lives, specifically because most people will come back into the community. And if they come back into the community having gone through all this violence, I mean, we see that as just a huge public health issue. So I just wanted to make sure that piece was connected. And I think Eric touched on it, and, you know, free calls was a good first step, but, you know, that's a very small piece of a much bigger puzzle.
Thank you. I wanted to just go back to, you know, when Eric was mentioning and the fact that there are groups like in Norfolk, but these other prisons don't have them. It seems like a simple thing to do, is just to allow for these kind of groups. And I'm just curious as to, like, what is a rationale? Like, why are these groups being pulled back? Is it, I mean, I have some ideas, but I'd like to hear from you all. If as to, you know, is it there is a fear of getting people together, or I don't know, Jesse, do you want to? Anyone can take
that. I can say what they've told us, and then I can say what I think the reason is. But what they've stated is, you know, that it's security concerns, and that's the blanket, you know, that's the blanket reason that DOC uses for pretty much all of what it does. It, you know, getting people together is too many enemies issues they might not know about, you know, getting people together might, you know, cause riots, you know, like they'll just sort of like hearken to the worst case scenario, and they don't look at the evidence before them, which is that, you know, the groups at Norfolk function just fine. You know, like, I don't, you know, you've got a guy in Sousa, and you could go to Norfolk the very next day and join a group, right? So it's not a reasonable rationale. It's not an evidence-based rationale. It's what they actually, but it's what they say. I think that, you know, the reality is that the prison system is built to isolate people and to disappear people, and that the and to disappear social problems, frankly, the lack of programming and education and group activities that are authorized is part of that isolation and punishment mentality that undergirds the whole system. And I would just add to what Erica and Ivy were saying about the funding issue is, you know, I think we should always be thinking about, like, we fund what we value. And right now our funding says that what we value is punishment, isolation, mental and physical harm. And I couldn't agree with Eric more that, you know, really calls into question the entire system and how it operates.
And it should be noted that, you know, with the closing of Walpole and then Concord, the staffing is overstaffed pretty much across the board. You know, like, we're talking a 2-to-1 ratio at some of these facilities. And so the suggestion of understaffing is just fundamentally untrue. Not to mention the incredible amount of overtime these folks are ranking in. You know, go look up the salaries if you want to, you know, really get enraged. But, you know, that's just not what it is. And, you know, they can't get rid of the lifers group at Norfolk. That is a mandate. So that's the reason that exists, is because they literally cannot get rid of it. I think they would otherwise. But I mean, yeah, exactly what Jesse said. We fund what we value, and there's just no one who's going to hold them accountable to doing this stuff that they're going to listen to. And our legislator votes in secret. Sorry, Erica, I know you put in that bill, but, you know, I think that we can't overstate how big of a deal that is. And maybe, Eric, you can touch on that if you want. A little outside the scope, but important.
Yeah, I mean, I think that a big piece that's such a problem, right, is that the people closest to the pain and what's happening in prisons have for so long never had a seat at the table in the legislature. And I think, you know, when we took away the right for incarcerated people to vote, that had a huge impact too, because that was a political move, right, to disenfranchise both in terms of the ballot box, but also in terms of their voice, because now, you know, legislators for a very long time had really no reason to go to prisons and understand what's going on. And so I think that that's part of this sort of lack of understanding and lack of action. And then when you add on to the fact that the DOC makes it extremely difficult for legislators to hold them accountable, either by direct retaliation or intimidation, or making us wait 2.5 hours to get into the prison, that there's no reason, like, as you said, with the staffing, for that, I mean, like, literally, you're telling me, like, there's 90 COs and not one of them they were all preoccupied for 2 hours and I could not, you know, escort me inside. It's absolutely ludicrous. And yeah, I do think that the sort of need for political will is a challenging obstacle for us to overcome. And I think the one thing that I'll say that I'm very pleased with, and I know a number of people here work very hard to make this a reality, which is that for currently incarcerated people to be able to testify live into the legislature and into hearings, I know that was a formative experience for every legislator who sat in on those hearings and heard directly from people in their lived experiences. And so I think that that, you know, is a very small step into more accountability and transparency in the legislature. So we cannot just cast this whole, you know, the people who are directly impacted by the system to be rendered invisible like they have been. And so I think that's kind of a key point, not to jump ahead of ourselves, but in terms of the work ahead of us is about of overcoming that.
Oh, thank you so much. I know Eric, it looks like you might have to jump off. Do you want to have any, do you want to add anything before you have to get off, or?
I'll just like to add that for me, like, I meant to add that as a support earlier, just from the legal world, because when it came to Northeastern Legal Services, Harvard Legal Services, Prison Legal Services, I don't think they even realize how much of a companion they come to the men inside the prisons, how much of a resource they come, how much of a center a whole. But really, realistically, it's the outside community. It takes, you know, Erica, it takes, you know, individuals to be able to come in that gave, that gives individuals that hope, give individuals that feel of community to be able to want, sometimes even want to go back out into community, to want to have those connections, to want to do good so they can make it there. You know, so I was like to say, it's that heartful feeling that you're given from your outside community, no matter if it's the legal services, your own lawyer, the judges, or the individuals that are able to come into the prison. It's when you're isolated and you're ostracized as being not one of the community, is when you feel like what is there to live for? What is there to care for? When it's CO versus inmate, when it should be, this person is a community member helping you get through your process, not that they're a CO and you're an inmate. I just like to add that and say thank you to everybody.
Appreciate it, Eric. Thanks so much. I wanted to just turn to actually like some of the things that you all are working on. We've heard a lot about what's going on, like what are the problems? And I think we've touched a little bit on what needs to change, but I'd love to hear, and I'm sure our members would love to hear also about like, what is it that you all are doing to address some of these issues? And I'll start with Ivy.
Sure. I mean, I think one thing that we do, and it's wonderful of Eric to say that, is to just build connections and build community. And we do a lot of, you know, Eric's got all the spreadsheets, and we've got, you know, all these people that we talk to, that we communicate with, who sometimes are just reaching out to say, you know, Happy Easter, but it's a way to build community and make sure you know what's going on behind the wall, really. And I think that's a pejorative term sometimes used, but I think it's a very real term of, you know, what is happening. Specifically, you know, going after WellPath and these organizations that are supposed to be providing care and making sure that they're actually doing that. There's a lot of creative ways, especially, you know, we've been pushing around the idea of, you know, what would it look like to have telehealth mental health? You know, take the person who is providing you that service, they're outside the prison, they're not part of the COs, they maybe have more of a lived experience to share, or just, you know, are not a young white woman, you know, because that's the majority of people who are working in these prisons as these care workers, and they just don't always have that same background that can really be helpful. We are also, you know, holding accountable what treatment really looks like and making sure that the COs are not stepping in between that clinical role. And really just shining light. That's really the biggest thing right now for us, is trying to make sure we know what's going on. We're providing creative solutions, and they keep denying them, but we can keep trying. And then, you know, accountability where it's possible with lawsuits and just going in and showing up over and over again. A lot of ABA. So I'll pass it to Jesse.
Yeah, this is a great question, and I have a multifaceted answer that I'll try to keep brief. But I think the first and most important thing that we're doing is anything we possibly can towards decarceration. I think that, you know, therapy requires vulnerability, right? And then you're thrust immediately back into an environment where vulnerability is not safe. So like we need to get people out of prison to get people the mental health care that we need. And we need to keep people out of prison instead of the current system that sort of uses prison and punishment as a response to mental health care needs. We have to shift how we do this. And we're doing it already. We're partway there, right? We just have a little further to go. But you know, we already have one of the lowest incarceration rates in the country. And I think that Massachusetts could go much further than it's already gone, right? Because if you look internationally, we still have one of the highest incarceration rates internationally. So that's just to say, I think we need to shift that paradigm. In the meantime, you know, while we're working towards decarceration, which I think we have to keep front and center anytime we're talking about mental health care, we also, you know, do what we can to try to improve the prison environment. So one thing that we've been pushing this legislative session is a bill that would create a baseline standard for conditions of confinement across the Commonwealth, including out-of-cell time, including the ability to create and join self-help affinity groups and other organizations across the system, no matter what prison you're in. A mental health care standard that's in line with community standards of care. I mean, I could go on and on, but that bill, I think, would go a long way towards creating an environment that at least somewhat supports human dignity and autonomy, at least a little bit better than it currently does, which could help people get to a place where when they get out, they're set up better for success instead of being set up for failure like they are right now. And then I would just say, you know, the last thing and probably the most sort of like in the moment thing that needs to change is how we respond to mental health crisis in the prison system. The use of Mental Health Watch was investigated by the DOJ. It was found to be, it was found to be a constitutional violation, what Massachusetts was doing to people in crisis. And the prison system has largely responded to that investigation the way they respond to everything. They changed the name of Mental Health Watch from Mental Health Watch to Therapeutic Confinement. But is it therapeutic? No, it's still Mental Health Watch. It's still isolation. It's still effectively being thrown in worse conditions than solitary confinement when you're at one of the lowest moments that you may have ever been at. And then we don't actually address the underlying problem that led to the crisis. We instead, if someone states that they've stabilized, whether that's true or not, we put them right back in the same conditions that they were in before they were put on mental health care. So I think we've got the acute problem, we've got the conditions problem, and then we've got, you know, sort of the biggest thing is let's get our community members out. Let's fund our communities to support each other. I think those are some of the things I would add. And then the BBA was nice enough to put into the chat our pro bono resources. We are always looking for folks who want to get involved in the work, and there's lots of different ways to get involved. So I encourage people to check that out.
Thanks so much. Representative, what are some things that you're working on that you'd like to touch on?
Yeah, well, I can't, I have to echo what Jesse said. Decarceration is the path. We have to really keep our laser focus on that. And I just want to also emphasize, I mean, decarceration can mean many things. It means passing legislation like ending life without parole, joint venture, second look. There's all these ways that our carceral system is used to maintain the social order, and it has nothing to do with accountability. And so to address that first and foremost, particularly from a racial justice and class lens is critical. So I think that is just number one to always keep at the forefront. And at the second piece of that too, is that even with the current regulations and laws in place, the we are over incarcerating people, and it's because we give the Department of Correction discretion to be able to do so. So despite having an objective points-based system, despite having all this documentation and bureaucracy around disciplinary reports or what have you in terms of assessing the public safety, right, or security level of individuals, we are still keeping people overwhelmingly in higher security for no reason other than that it costs the state more money and it creates more jobs. And And that is the only justification I can find. And so that as well can be addressed with advocacy from us in the legislature, because they're simply not following their own regulations and not following the law in order to preserve and preserve the system in place as it is. And then I think the other piece of this that from my lens as a legislator, because our role is to hold the Department of Correction accountable, it's an issue in a system that speaks for itself. I think that most legislators are appalled when they learn how obstinate and resistant and unwilling this $800 million agency is to providing us basic data requests, basic information. Even the program description booklet is full of errors up and down the entire booklet. It claims to have programs it has not had for at least decades. I've had lifers tell me they've never heard of these programs in their life. So, you know, those are all elements of accountability that I bring to the forefront, because it's something that I believe, strategically speaking, is something anyone from the far left to the far right of the political spectrum in the legislature can get behind, that the DOC needs to be held accountable by the legislature, because that is our legislative mandate. And, you know, we can make also a fiscal argument, right? I mean, here we are cutting funding to shelters, struggling to cut. We're cutting state aid. We're cutting funding to programs that we rely on our earmarks. And then meanwhile, we're letting this rogue agency just eat up all of this funding with no accountability. And they just keep coming back to us telling us they don't have enough staff. I mean, the whole thing is so outrageous. And again, I'm driven by this work for the humanity and the dignity of all people, whether incarcerated or in the community. Even if a legislator is not, right, you can agree that this is an abhorrent use of resources and is harmful to our whole state and is irresponsible. Those are all the things I just to share a glimpse as a legislator, right? My job is to persuade my colleagues. And so those are some of the angles and the ways that I think accountability helps bring us to this ultimate goal of decarceration. But really, it does come down to being able to bring the experiences and stories and the, you know, voices of people who are incarcerated to the legislature. They need to be in these halls of power, and that people need to hear them, because this is really at the core, right? It's going to be what changes hearts and minds in the state. So that is a big component of my work, as well as just in general, right? When we're told that everyone is getting driver's licenses, and then I have all these people leaving prison with no driver's license, right? I mean, it can be, there's accountability can be very systemic to, you know, very individual. And so just encourage people, at the very least, contact me if you don't know who to contact. If there's an issue like that, where there's a clear violation of what they're claiming their policy is and what is actually happening on the ground. So just want to make a plug for that, because it is something that is critical. The constituent services part of our role highlights, right, how the system is just simply not working and provides that transparency.
Thank you, Erica. And I see, Ivy, you have your hand up. I'm mindful of the time, and we want to make sure that we get to people's questions. We don't currently have any in the Q&A chat, but please go ahead and enter your questions there, and we'll make sure to ask them. I'll get us started, and hopefully, Ivy, you can incorporate your comment into the sort of first question. Erica, you talked a little bit about strategy, and I want to stay with that point for all of us, which is, you know, what lessons have each of you learned about what effective advocacy to pressure DOC looks like? We know there have been some wins, you know, and they mean a lot to people, whether it's the free phone calls. These are things that do support mental health, through the, you know, kind of, you know, removing some isolation, right, through being able to connect through the phone calls. I'm not sure if, you know, there were specific things that made that ultimately led to the passage of that specifically, or other wins that you've seen where DOC, despite the intransigence that we've heard about for the last hour, had no choice but to, you know, permit that. And what led to that? What organizing strategies led to that? And so maybe we can get started with you, Jesse, and then Ivy, and then Eric on that question. And in the meantime, love the participant questions if anyone has any.
Thank you. This is a great question. I really appreciate it. I think that the most effective strategy is one that really brings people into communication and collaboration with each other around these issues. And that includes incarcerated people and centers, making sure that incarcerated people are sort of at the table figuring out solutions. I think where we've gone wrong in the past is we have taken sort of a top-down methodology. We've taken a top-down way of thinking about how we change things. And we've sort of looked at it as, okay, you know, if we beg for this from the top, maybe we'll get a piece of it, right? That feels palatable in whatever political moment we're in. And that isn't to say we've had huge wins in spite of that top-down thinking. But I think something that No Cost Calls did really well and that we need to replicate is it really built the community for that from the bottom up. And it really ensured that incarcerated people were there, were helping to make decisions about strategy along the way, were helping to decide where compromises could happen and where they shouldn't happen. And I think that that is a really critical thing. I think part of what we need to do to make that happen is to continue increasing avenues of communication with folks inside, and then also collaborating more closely with each other. There are so many problems that exist. It's very easy for us, for our political power to get distributed so thinly that we can't get anything done. And I think that we have to come together and determine, like, what are our goals and how do we get there? And I think that at the center of all of those discussions needs to be what's within, like, our current circle of control that we can do right now to get people out of prison. And then sort of what's the next level of control after, like, where can we build more control toward that end? So I think that's some of what I've been thinking about and stewing about a lot. But I think coming together, identifying common values, common goals, and then bringing that pressure to bear in order to change current political imperatives is probably the best thing we can be doing with each other.
Hannah, I come from this. I'm a litigator. I'm not a legislative person, so I let them do that. But you know, I think one thing that we've been speaking about in terms of communication is at MHLAC, we do systemic litigation. We don't necessarily do individual litigation overall. And so what we've had success in doing is asking direct questions in a nice way and saying, you know, oh, this person's ADA accommodation was denied. Can you give us more information? And then, you know, doing that with the next person as well. And then getting sort of boxing them into the corners that they create for themselves and saying, okay, well, this doesn't make sense because this is completely inconsistent. And then, you know, when you start citing other cases, being able to bring those together and talk to Erica, talk to Jesse, talk to DLC, and really get that information together, I think they realize that they don't want a class action litigation. They don't actually want this. What they want is to make us go away. And so sometimes we're able to just pick slowly at this, you know, giant mound, and then it eventually can help and at least, you know, get some of the help for the guys individually as well. And just as a really quick aside, I just wanted to put a plug in that a lot of what MHLAC does as well is the school to prison pipeline and focusing on the community, because we talk a lot about decarceration. Well, it's people don't need to be in the system to begin with. And that also touches on the carceral approach to mental health and inpatient locked units, which is a whole other conversation. But, you know, when we're seeing inpatient units seeing 95% of their people coming in that are forensic, I think that's a bigger question. You know, why are people in mental health crisis even coming into contact with the courts and the police? Let's step back. Let's invest in behavioral health helpline, 988, community resources, and stop the carceral process from the beginning. So I think that's my little push there on what's been working. And just citing case law. They get really nervous anytime you cite a case law in a letter. So it's always good to drop that in. I'll pass it to you, Erica.
Erica, in your response, one thing we want to make sure that we sort of end with as well is the really clarifying how people can get involved. So I do appreciate that, you know, Jesse put in the link, you know, a pro bono kind of link, but some of our participants might be concerned, like they can't co-counsel a big case like with Ivy, which it sounds like you're doing amazing work, and they're not lawmakers, you know, necessarily. And so I think, you know, it'd be great as you talk about effective strategy and how do we bring people inside, outside families together, like what in like the most basic way can everybody even on this call do to sort of get involved? What can they join? What can they sign up for? What should they be supporting where you don't necessarily need to be co-counsel or something? And then I want to maybe go to Jesse. Are there ways for lawyers who don't have expertise in this area? What kinds of pro bono work would be meaningful to help somebody with mental health issues? You know, maybe just tease that out a little bit because it might not be discussed in that granular way on the website. So maybe we'll start with Erica. And again, Jesse, you'll have that last word and then Sarah can close us out.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'll just say, first off, everybody who is a resident of Massachusetts has a legislator who represents you. And I also just cannot emphasize enough, I understand this is a Boston Bar Association. I imagine there's a lot of legal folks watching and tuning in. I think we all have different privileges and we can kind of quibble about how that's not okay. And that honestly, I believe incarcerated people's voices should be the same as anyone else's. But, you know, legislators do have a bias, but they have a very strong bias, right, to listening to attorneys and lawyers who know the law. And so I'd say, please use that privilege that you have for good. And I think that's something, you know, I've had to lean on my legal advocacy partners all the time because, you know, someone might not listen to me because they're like, well, Erica's just doing her thing going into prisons. And then I'm like, no, but actually, did you know that these legal, you know, experts have said this? And then it's like the discussion's over. So just please, again, I can't emphasize that enough in terms of bringing that perspective. It has a lot of weight in the legislature. So please use it. And then I think that, you know, I certainly in terms of, you know, legislation, there is a lot of great legislation out there. And I think that's something that we do have to build towards in terms of coalition work and figuring out like what are our fundamental asks. But I think any bill that is pushing for decarceration is absolutely needed and people need to hear those stories. Because again, I think, you know, if we don't bring those to people's attention, right, it's so easy for it to get lost in the shuffle. So I can't emphasize enough how important that is. And that's something too, I'm encouraging everyone I work with behind the wall. They have family and friends, they know people in the community, right? How can we support? I'd say really trying to get in front of your legislator. And I'll also add that every legislator has the statutory right to go to any prison. So please ask them to do that. And preferably ask them to do that unannounced. And if they're like, I've never done that before, how do I do it? Tell them to give me a call and I'm happy to go unannounced. I always need a partner with me because it is not safe for me to go alone. So you're helping both me and the, you know, the cause. So I just want to just put those two plugs in. And then in terms of strategy, I just, this is where to me, it kind of goes hand in hand and why it's so important to be working shoulder to shoulder with incarcerated people. I've learned how the DOC works and how to navigate them and how to be strategic and how to not let them wear you down from incarcerated people, whether formerly or currently incarcerated. It is a longstanding institution. I'd say it's as longstanding as the original sin of this country. And it is designed to, you know, put you in a reactive space, constantly flood us with problems, right? But they're also, it's an institution of habit. They have a way of wearing down the court system, wearing down legislators, wearing down like legal, right? And so there's a way to be strategic about that and move strategically to sort of navigate that issue. But I just wanted to share that perspective because that I think a lot of us have that experience when you first kind of dip your toes into this. And that's what happened to me as a legislator. You're just like, oh my gosh, there's just like constant crisis all the time. And that system is designed to do that. And if anything, right, they are designed to wear down the court system, right? Until they get a judge they want, they're going to keep litigating this thing to death. And so I just want to just share that perspective that is very overcomable through figuring out the right strategies. I also know that it's a system that is very reactive, right? So they will react in ways that is not in their best interest. If I were, you know, in their head, I would not have done that, but they'll do things that, you know, on full display, right, that harms their cause. And so there's ways to sort of navigate. So I just wanted to at least put in that plug around strategy, because I want to take it away from maybe like this amorphous idea of like contact your legislator to like, there are things that we can do about, you know, ways to litigate, ways to push, what asks to make, right? What, you know, demands to make of legislators to put attention on the issue. And I'll just say, you know, just very quickly that this whole system relies on two things. It relies on keeping incarcerated people invisible and keeping decision makers like me ignorant. And so if you're doing anything to address either of those, right, you're moving in the right direction. So thank you all so much for being here.
Thank you, Erica. Jesse, did you want to go ahead?
Yeah, thanks so much. So I would plus one to everything Erica just said, and I would just add there are so many different mechanisms to get involved, from very low resource things like working with one incarcerated person and just addressing their needs as they arise. I can't tell you, like, every incarcerated person might have anywhere from 1 to 15 needs that you could help address, because you can help lend power to their voice and lend your sort of privilege of your bar card to their voice, right? Lawyers are able to meet with incarcerated people confidentially. We're able to communicate with incarcerated people confidentially if it's for the purpose of providing legal advice or finding out if someone needs legal assistance. So anyone could get into communication with even just a single incarcerated person and try to help get their immediate needs met. I think that's something really concrete folks can do. There's also low resources mechanisms to try to get people out. So there's, you know, clemency petitions are not that hard to put together. Our legal skills are precisely attuned to allow us to do that pretty easily. And there are resources available to help teach you how to do that. Likewise, medical parole petitions, getting people out who are really sick and who are getting ready to die is something that's a fairly low resource way to get involved. And then, of course, there's the much higher resource ways of co-counseling on big systemic litigation cases, which are definitely awesome if you're part of a big firm and can take on some of that load. I'll say legal services organizations are stretched really thin, and we really rely on support from law firms that come with more resources and with more labor power that they can help put into these issues. And then I would say, there was one more thing I wanted to say, and now I'm forgetting what it was. But so basic administrative advocacy, feel free to reach out to legal services organizations that are involved, and we can put you in touch with people who are incarcerated so that you can become advocates for them on a day-to-day basis, or with them on a day-to-day basis really is a better way to look at it. Oh, and then the last thing is there's so much good organizing work that's happening that lawyers could bring their skills to help increase the capacity of those movements. So there's a Coalition for Effective Public Safety that's focused on parole reform work. There's the Campaign to End Life Without Parole that's focused on extreme sentencing. There's Parole Watch, which is paying attention to parole hearings and bringing transparency to that process. There's Massachusetts Against Solitary Confinement focused on conditions. Any number of these organizations need more capacity and could make use of the skills that we bring to bear as lawyers.
Thank you, Jesse. And just a comment from the participants, the Women's Bar Foundation has started a clemency project. And so if any lawyers want to connect with clients, you can go it's to provide training and mentorship. You can go to the Women's Bar Foundation. And if you're interested in learning more, you can go there to learn about that. And just in closing, so I think the big takeaway is that we need to change the system, and we all have a role to play. And there are many ways to be able to join and help, big or small. And so we really hope that you leave this with some ideas and really get involved. And even if it's just having a conversation about something you learned today, please keep that conversation going, because we can't change things unless we have your help. So thank you to our panelists, and thank you all for joining. Really appreciate it, and I hope you have a great rest of the day.
The BBA is Boston's largest legal network built on justice, community, education, and inclusion. Take advantage of our exclusive Express membership offer and save 50% off BBA membership through August 31st, 2024. Enjoy the full benefits of BBA membership and take advantage of BBA programs and events, discounts on services, access to the full Learn Online library, and much more. This special offer is only available through March 15th, 2024. Use code EXPRESS50 at checkout.